So now we have spoken about the three non-virtues of body or physical non-virtues, four of speech, and we complete this particular outline with three non-virtuous karmas of mind. As I mentioned, these refer to the development of the non-virtuous intentions or motivations of maliciousness, covetousness, or wrong views, which leads one up to the point of engaging in an action, a verbal or a physical action. So those verbal or physical actions are called karmic actions. The mental non-virtues are karmas, they're not actions because they're not actually physical or verbal actions. So they're called karmic paths. Path, the term path in Buddhism generally refers to a state of mind. And when we talk about the true path, it refers to the mental attainments on the path to enlightenment. So the path to enlightenment is actually a mental, progressive mental development, in particular the wisdom seeing reality and the accumulation of virtue with that. So the path here, when they say that these three are karmic paths, they're karmic means that they are that they are associated with ignorance. The karma refers to actions performed by a mind which is contaminated by ignorance. Buddhas and Arya Bodhisattvas, they perform actions, but their mind is not contaminated by manifest ignorance. Not the Arya Bodhisattva. They have ignorance, but it's not manifest in the Arya Bodhisattva. So instead of their actions creating the cause for rebirth in the wheel of life, the actions of the Arya Bodhisattvas on the higher paths to enlightenment create accumulation of virtue, the result of which is the attainment of the Buddha's form body, the Sambhogakaya, Rupakaya, and the Pure Lands that are emanated through the power. Once a person becomes a Buddha, their wisdom mind is called the Dharmakaya, and because of the accumulation of virtue, of positive energy, through the Dharmakaya, they automatically create a pure land where bodhisattvas can be born and receive the teachings and where they teach. So you see, we don't call that karma because specifically we refer by the term karma, it refers to actions done by a mind contaminated by manifest ignorance. But it's a similar process. Now, like for us, we create our environments. We've already said, as hell beings, we completely create our hell environment. The same hungry ghost environment, animal, human environment, this is a result of the collective karma of all the sentient beings who inhabit the world. Of course, each individual sentient being experiences the world according to their specific karma, but there are many common things that we experience collectively if we don't analyze too closely. But even like this room, but the two humans in this room, they have a slightly different perception of this room according to the individual karma. There is a common room in general, but if we really check up, each has their own take, or whatever, their own experience of the room. I think my teacher, Geshe Jaba Techo, once gave an illustration of collective karma is like a big cake. And specific individual karma is when you cut the one cake up into slices and each person gets a different slice of cake. It's sort of like an attempt to illustrate the meaning of individual karma. Okay, so the first of the non-virtues of mind is covetousness. So covetousness is not just simple desire. It's a longing to possess the property of somebody else, and that longing gives rise to the desire to attain that property in an improper manner. There are four branches that we talk about, the mental karmas. These all occur in one sequence of thought, whereas the verbal and physical karmas, motivation and the action that occurs over quite a long time, involved in generating the idea and then doing it, completing it, and so on. But here, the four branches occur in one sequence of thought. So there's the object, a quality or a possession of someone else, the motivation, unmistaken recognition, the full intention to acquire the object. It's not just the thought, what he's got looks nice, I'd like to have that. That's not covetousness. Covetousness begins with that, oh, I'm going to get that. I'm going to steal it from him. You know, it's more. It's more than just wanting to have something. Clearly, strong attachment is the main, the affliction that's present in covetousness. So, in the teachings, it says that covetousness it overwhelms our mind with desire, and leads us right up to the point of engaging in one of the non-virtuous actions of body or speech to obtain the object. So, in terms of the action branch, then there are five factors which make the action complete. And so you can see in these how strong it has to be. The first, exceptional desire, wanting the object for oneself. Greed, wanting more than what one already has. Nosiness, such as in, oh, what have you got? Oh, I want that too. Competitiveness, vying to do better, greedily wanting another's pleasure for oneself. And shameless intention to acquire the object by any non-virtuous means. So they're quite strong. And that's the meaning of covetousness. The completion of the act is when all of these desires bring us to the point of engaging in a physical, verbal non-virtue. Three types of result also occur. The throwing result, rebirth in one of the three lower realms, results similar to the cause. There will be one will have instinctive, strong desires, and in terms of our experience, one will begin, for example, one will begin many projects, but one won't complete any of them. The environmental result should be, if we're a farmer, then we'll have meagre crops, and our wealth and possessions will deteriorate. So that gives us a picture of covetousness, not just ordinary desire, very powerful. And malice is, you know, harmfulness, also in a similarly strong type. In general, it's having hatred towards sentient beings and dwelling in a state of harmfulness, a harmful attitude towards others, you know, belligerent. There might be a certain group of people who we dislike because they follow the other football team, you know, they follow my football team. So we just have to see the colours of their scarves and we're belligerent. There's this don't like, hurt them. So the object is a sentient being who we can hurt. Motivation, a mistake of recognition of the object, the full intention to physically hurt or verbally hurt, and there's strong anger. I really want to hurt you. The action also has five components which make it maliciousness. First is deep hostility, grasping at a reason to hurt, such as resenting past harm that the person has caused us. We're very belligerent. Inability to restrain the mind from intending to inflict harm. So we just can't stop ourselves wanting to hurt. Grudge holding, from having dwelt again and again upon the reasons for being hostile towards that person. Fourthly, a competitive attitude, seeing this person who you see as an enemy as a rival and seeking vengeance. And shamelessness, intending to go ahead with the action, no sense of doing wrong. Those who have studied low rig, you know there's a presentation of 11 virtuous mental factors, and amongst those there are two. One is refrain, or both of them are refraining from non-virtue, and one is through a sense of shame, that it wouldn't be right for me to do this in the eyes of my teacher and Buddha and so on. It's shameful to engage in the non-virtuous action. And the other is a sense of not caring, carelessness about the person towards whom you're going to hurt. Those two are said to be the roots of all virtue. So the completion branch is when we make the final decision to harm the other person through physical or verbal action. It does occur in the hells, where people always hate each other. It's not present in the northern continent, but it's present elsewhere in the desire realm. And the three types of result also can occur. Rebirth in the hells or another lower realm. Results similar to the cause, that one instinctively has aggressiveness and maliciousness. And the environmental result is where a farmer, our crops might fail, or we're born in a place of war, calamities, epidemics, dangerous animals and so on. Then the third mental non-virtue is holding, in general it says wrong views, but specifically what it means is holding distorted views which contradict the teachings of the Buddha, the sort of reality explained by the Buddha. So this means having strong views, which, for example, which deny the reality of karmic cause and effect, deny the possibility of nirvana, enlightenment, denying the three jewels, and so on. So it's not just not understanding about karma and so on, or not believing in karma. It's a fully held antagonistic view which stubbornly denies reality. So the object of wrong views is something which is correct, which is true. And not true just because Buddha said so, but true, but a reality that when investigated cannot be proven wrong and is found to be true, such as rebirth, karmic cause and effect, nirvana, enlightenment, which if we analyze these facts taught by Buddha, we can definitely, intellectually, conclude that they're true. We cannot disprove them. So the motivation has the three aspects: unmistaken recognition of the object, we understand what we're denying, and we have full comprehension of the meaning of our mistaken view, but we grasp at it as to be true, whereas in fact it's incorrect. There's a full intention to hold this view against reason and to undermine the way, the presentation of the way things are. So it is, it's a competitive, antagonistic attitude, state of mind. Clearly the predominant affliction is closed-minded ignorance. In terms of the action, this way of thinking with wrong views also has to have five aspects. First is blindness from not knowing that something knowable is true. That is, we're blind to reality. Second is contentiousness. Sort of, we say we have this fighting attitude, which comes from a perverse sense of enjoying being negative. I don't know if you've got, you may have friends like that. Most of my group of friends in Australia were, you know, we had a big circle of, you know, university students and art school students, and we were like weren't a gang, but we were a clique of friends in Melbourne during the 1960s, quite a time. And the first ones were a couple from Australia, Nick Rebush, who some of you may know, and his girlfriend Marie. They went to Copan in 1972, and they met the lamas and became monk and nun, and they wrote all these constant letters back to their friends in Melbourne, in Australia, saying, stop everything and you must come to Nepal and listen to these lamas. And I think for the first course in 1973, which was maybe the third meditation course at Copan, there were over 20 of our group went to Copan Monastery in Nepal to attend the one-month meditation course, including Nick's mother, his brother, my brother, but I didn't go. I was the last to go. But I remember Nick, Nick was saying, drop everything, come to Nepal, learn about Buddhism. And I wrote back, I said, no, my immediate friends, we're travelling up the east coast of Australia, we see that there's something wrong with society, so we're going to buy some land and develop a commune, and we will show society the right way to live, our way. So his reply to that, which came in a letter, was, it's peace of mind you want, not peace of land. Anyway, I eventually wound up at Copan a year or two later. So, why I got talking about this story was about the contentiousness. One of our, the only one of our big group of friends who didn't go, he played the role of devil's advocate, contentious, a perverse sense of enjoying being the negative one and not becoming a Buddhist. He's still playing that role, and we still debate whenever I meet him. But although there's no way he would admit to being a Buddhist, he still gets up at 3 o'clock every morning and meditates for 2 hours, which is much more than I do. But his pride is such that he will never, well, maybe he will one day. He might call himself a Buddhist, but the role he has chosen It's the pity of the individual. All right. I'm sure his motivation is pure. I'm not criticizing him at all. In fact, it's good to have, you know, debate, intellectual debate, and everything he questions, you know, like we'll put the Dalai Lama up as being Chinrezig, you know, Buddha, way back, it's in the 70s, looking at me with this serious look. Why does the Dalai Lama wear glasses if he's so perfect? Why would he need them? I said, there's no such thing as a perfect human being, which is the Dalai Lama manifests as a human being. Okay. The third point about wrong views is to completely believe that what you understand is true, but in dependence upon a mistaken reason. You don't know it's mistaken, but it is. Well, I say it is. But there are correct things and there are incorrect things, okay? So who's to say which? Well, at times we might rely on the authority of the Buddha or our teacher, but the main authority to assess whether something is incorrect or correct is our own inner wisdom. You know, we have to cultivate. This is the path, remember? Wisdom is the fourth noble truth, the path to enlightenment. And of course, initially we depend upon others, but we must gain an idea of what Dharma means and have something to refer when questions come. We must be able to refer it to our inner structure of the Dharma, and there is a structure. That's one of the great things about meditation retreat. You know, say the graduated path, which is condensed presentation of all Buddha's teachings, and that's what we're talking about now, one aspect of it. But there are many different points, and so often, I've heard Lam Rim so often, I don't want to hear it anymore. I want something new. But there is nothing new, because the Lam Rim contains the entire teachings of Buddha. In my first, before I decided to become a monk, I had received Lam Rim teachings and had lots of information, and then did 3-month retreat. And what happened was that they all came together, fitting like a jigsaw. And so there was this rational picture developed of understanding. So that's the beginning of one's inner wisdom. I remember one time Lama Yeshe at Kopan, people went for appointments, and one time I saw them come out of the door of the monastery where his room was, and there was a student who'd been there for an appointment, and Lama Yeshe followed her, and he was still talking to her, and he was saying, "Use your own wisdom, dear. Next time, or soon, you'll be asking me whether to go to the toilet or not. Use your own wisdom." And he said that so often. And often we ask lamas questions, but they won't give us a direct answer. They'll give some hint or some very skillful reply that will make us, what did he mean by that? We have to think about it. We have to use our own wisdom. Because, you know, our life is our own. We have to face our family, our work, our situations in life. We have to face illness, we have to face aging, we have to face death. Really on our own. If we're constantly wanting to task somebody else, then we won't cultivate the habit of using our own wisdom. The answers have been given to us already in the Lam Rim. Now, I've been the attendant of the Lamas on many different occasions, and so, you know, people come for interviews, they're always asked, they hardly ever ask Dharma questions. They always ask questions about their personal life. And, you know, I was sort of trying to be an inconspicuous person in the room, but I hear it, and I hear the Lama's reply. And it's always straightforward Lam Rim, which the students have already heard, but they just need to have it said again. And anyway, I think you know what I mean. All right. The fourth part of the action of wrong viewers is being totally mean in repudiating the values of positive things like charity, love, Dharma practice, and so on. And see how heavy that is. Now, not only do we hold to our antagonistic view, but we're really mean in rejecting another person's wish to meditate, to, you know, do prostrations, or, you know, to do Dharma action. That's ridiculous. That is so destructive. Anyway, finally, a headstrong attitude, wanting to beat somebody, shamelessly being antagonistic. So the completion is a final decision to deny the teachings by declaring them to be untrue and asserting the opposite. The results, also there's the rebirth result, usually reborn in the lower realms, because wrong view is the heaviest of all the karmas of body, speech and mind. Wrong views are the heaviest because they completely obstruct one's own engaging in Dharma practice, and through that action we obstruct the Dharma practice of others. So it is the heaviest negative karma. The maliciousness is the next heavy mental karma, and covetousness is the lightest mental karma. The result of the cause, of course, is that we will instinctively adhere to incorrect views and will be constantly deceitful towards others. And in terms of our experience, when we're trying, if we are in a future life and we meet Dharma teaching, we're trying to understand them, but it's going to be so hard. It's been the scriptures like there will be like a pot over our head. We just can't get the meaning of the teachings. This is a karmic result from past wrong views. There's actually a lot of commentary on karma. In the notes that I gave you, sort of I've extracted, I think, the important points. The next outline is differences that make these actions heavy or light. So in terms of the nature, then the seven non-virtues of body and speech, these are heaviest, from killing down to stealing, down to sexual misconduct, and then down to lying, harsh speech, slander, I can't remember the order, slander or harsh speech, and idle gossip. So they get lighter as you go down that way. And I've already mentioned how the mental non-virtues, wrong views, are the heaviest. The object. Also, our karmic action is heavy or light independence upon the object. It's much heavier to create negative karma towards one's guru, towards bodhisattvas, towards sangha, those who are living in vows and have achieved realizations, and one's parents. The reason is pretty obvious, because we're dependent upon our parents for our life, for growing up, for our education. So much, we have such a strong karmic connection with our parents. And so anything we do, positive or negative, is very heavy karmically towards our parents. So to help them creates great virtue, and to harm them, great non-virtue. And practitioners, if we interfere with bodhisattvas in the Dharma practice, we're not only an obstacle to them, but we're an obstacle to all sentient beings. Because a bodhisattva is, by definition, is a person who is acting for the benefit of all sentient beings. So if we impede their activity, we're harming all sentient beings. Hugely negative. The intention, right? Remember, intention is a mental factor. It is purpose or will, that strong movement of our mind to do something or to engage in an action. So the stronger the intention, the stronger the karma. You know, if we kill maliciously without any compassion, and even sadistically, you know, causing more harm, then that karma is obviously much heavier than, say, killing an animal out of a sense of kindness, or you're not wishing to hurt it. In Mongolia, where I lived for 4 years, they live very much on animal meat. I mean, half the year the land is snow and ice. You can't grow vegetables. And anyway, they say that Mongolians don't grow vegetables. We herd animals. They also say Chinese grow vegetables, not Mongolians. Little bit of nationalism there. So, but when they kill a sheep, they say mantras, and they try to do it in as least painful a way as possible. Pretty gruesome the way they do it, but the reasoning is as least harm as possible in killing the animal. And they really do have this genuine attitude of fondness for their animals. It's really true in Mongolia. You know, a lot of I was there for 4 years, and I learned a bit of their culture, which is really fantastic. And of course, they're nomadic herdsmen living in these Hessian tents and so, moving, following the pastures in the mountains in the summer and the plains in the winter and so on. And so when they go visit their friends, then the first question that they ask is, well, usually this is the male members, they say, how are your animals? And then the next question is, how's your family? And they have so many different types of animals, like sheep and goats and yaks and camels and horses and cows. And they have a specific language with which they address each species of animal. And they do have this remarkable bond connection with their animals. It's really beautiful to see. Unless you've been brought up in the city, like my translator, who was very scared of cows and horses and things. But anyway, the point is that although they do kill animals for survival, they try to do it as minimal harm to the animals possible, and they say mantras. It's still negative karma, but it's so much lighter than killing without caring about the suffering that you inflict upon the animal. So that's the next point. The more harm involved in the action, then the stronger the karma. to kill by torture is clearly much heavier than kill swiftly. The frequency of doing an action over and over again increases the heaviness. You know, the description of one hell experience is that if you have been a fisherman or a slaughterer, and then you experience being caught between two mountains which are in the shape of the heads of animals or fish that you have killed frequently, and they just come together and there's no escape, they crush you, they separate, you revive, they crush you again. So this is due to the frequency of being an habitual slaughterer or fisherman, whatever. Finally, actions are much heavier when there's no opponent power. One has not invoked one of the four or all of the four opponent powers to overcome the negative action. We'll talk about the four opponent powers, such as taking the precepts, creating virtue, generating sincere regret, supremely through meditation on emptiness. When we attain the direct single-pointed realization of emptiness, that wisdom is so powerful that it will destroy all negative karmas that have been accumulated and are continuing. So at that point, one becomes an Arya being, and one will no longer or ever again create throwing karma, and you will never again be reborn under the control of karma in samsara. You still are not out of samsara, but the rebirths you take to complete your path will be taken by choice. You'll have the power to choose where to be reborn in order to fulfill your path. We've talked about the negative karmas or black karmas, but equally we could talk in the same depth of detail about white karmas, the 10 virtuous karmas, which are the opposites, the virtuous karma of not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, and so on. So these virtuous actions, they're not merely refraining from the non-virtues. It's not just avoiding. But they require the four branches to be complete. So, one sees the faults of negative actions, and we recognize them to be wrong, and that they'll bring unpleasant results. And so, we generate virtue with the intention to avoid such actions of killing, and we do so. So there might be a situation where a mosquito is annoying us, and before we learn about karma, we would have squashed it and rejoiced, got rid of that pest. But now, having learned about karma, we actively restrain ourselves from that action. We think, no, that little mosquito used to be my mother in past lives. It just wants a little drink of blood, and to kill it would be so negative. So we refrain. We don't. We save it so I might catch it and put it out the window or whatever, but we don't kill it. That's a difficult one for me. I have trouble with mosquitoes, especially at night. One time, when in the mid-70s, when I was a monk at Kopan, and I opened a clinic I called the People's Clinic for the monks at the monastery and visitors, as well as all the village people in Kathmandu, particularly on the ridge where Kopan Monastery is. So I had lots of medicines that friends sent from Australia, and I had a clinic from 8 in the morning till midday. And I had this constant stream of Nepalese with a whole spectrum of some incredibly sick who I was able to help. And Rinpoche asked me, when I got a message to see Lama Zofa Rinpoche, he had some infection on his ear, so I took up some ointment for this infection. And I was in his room, and he said to me, "I had lots of injections last night." I said, "What? Injection?" And he showed me his arms, and they were just covered in mosquito bites. You know, we'd heard about this, but I didn't really believe that, well, with Lama Zofa anything could happen. But he showed me. And Roger Kunseng, his attendant, told me that one time he and Rinpoche, they were on pilgrimage to a holy site in India, and that night they were sharing a very sort of out of the village, a small hotel. So they were sharing this room together with Roger and Rinpoche. And in the evening, Roger had finished saying his mantras, so the beds had four posts and a mosquito net rolled up, and you could roll it down. And so he prepared his bed, rolled down the mosquito net, and Lama Zofa Rinpoche was just sitting in the middle of his bed meditating. And so Roger just quietly let down Lama Zofa's mosquito net and tucked it into the mattress. Rinpoche didn't say anything. Roger did that, then he went to sleep. Then, in the middle of the night, he woke up and looked across at Lama Zofa. The lights were still on, because Rinpoche always keeps all the lights, you know, lots of lights, they're offerings. What a great opportunity to offer to the Buddha. So the lights were on, and Rinpoche was still meditating on the bed, but he had rolled the mosquito net up, and he'd pulled his shirt over his head, exposing his back, and his back was black with mosquitoes. And Rinpoche was just offering them their dinner. So that's the bodhisattva attitude. We talk about all sentient beings, but can we really do that for half a dozen, or not? Maybe hundreds of mosquitoes. Very difficult. What is the meaning of bodhicitta? And not just, it's not like self-inflicted pain. Genuine love, compassion, and delight in being able to give one's past mothers a little drink of blood. And Rinpoche did this all the time. In India, so many mosquito-borne diseases. I got malaria once just from a few mosquito bites. Rinpoche never contracted a mosquito-borne illness, even though you would have thought that he would have more than others. So virtuous, the 10 virtuous actions are, instead of stealing, one resists temptation to steal, and one gives with great delight, whatever. If people admire what you have, then what a great opportunity to give it to them. Sexual misconduct, the temptation is there, and you refrain, and you remain loyal to your own partner, and it makes life so less complicated and so fruitful. Because even if one is unfaithful to one's spouse doesn't know. Aware of having an affair, theoretically making life happier, but there's always this inner sense of unease. You've betrayed the person you're living with. And you actually, it's very difficult to be truly, peacefully happy with the person you're living with when you're betraying him or her. So, the opposite of what one thinks is what actually happens. Okay, and so the others are clear. Instead of lying, just speaking truthfully and honestly all the times. It makes you, people admire you, they trust you, they will seek your advice, and they will take your advice when you're always speaking truthfully. When we lie, we completely stop any sense of respect that others may have for us. You know, especially when we're caught out. There are certain politicians, I won't name any, but who you're probably aware of, whose incredible cover-up of what they do and lying and obstacles for the truth to come out. And they just live in this realm of untruthfulness and become more insecure. They have to tell more lies until it explodes, like poor old President Nixon, who could not cover up anymore. Maybe the current president might succeed in his cover-up. I feel sorry for him because I think one, his day will come. I don't want him to suffer, but he's creating the cause. Anyway, we shouldn't gossip about politics unless we could do something about it. Harsh speech, for sure. Speaking kindly and gently with motivation to ease another person's worries is such a beautiful form of charity. It's actually giving love, the charity of giving love, but by speaking kind, pleasing words. And even we don't have the wisdom to help a person sort out their problem, just by speaking kindly, that is such a benefit, such a relief to them, rather than harshly abusing them for being stupid and getting into that situation. I told you he was no good. She was no good. You know. And not gossiping, as I mentioned, about sport and so on. But using all words in a constructive sense, not even moaning or complaining, but every sound that comes out of here should only come when there's a genuine, positive, constructive reason for doing it. And it can mean exclamations and laughter. It doesn't mean you have to be like a zombie and emotionless. Nothing like laughter, genuine, happy laughter, to put people at ease. So telling jokes, etc., can be virtuous depending upon the motivation. Fooling around, messing around, acting like a drunk, all of those things which associated with the non-virtuous mind were negative karma, those actions can be done in a positive way with positive intention. So they're the virtuous actions. The karma according to its nature, well, we've virtually covered that. Throwing karma causes rebirth in the upper or lower realms. One point is that one throwing karma, one action, can be the cause for one rebirth or multiple rebirths. And many karmas can be the cause for one rebirth. So there's a difference. It's not just one karma, one birth, etc. There's a whole variation in possibilities. Accomplishing karma and completing karma, well, these terms are a bit more specifically related to the presentation of the 12 links, which is I think the last weekend we'll be here. We'll be talking about the 12 links. But when you hear the term accomplishing karma, that refers to the 8th, 9th and 10th of the 12 links, the craving, grasping and existence. So they're called accomplishing because towards the end of life, through craving, which is a type of desire, and then grasping is an even stronger desire as we're approaching death, grasping at life, grasping at me, and not wanting to die. So that's the 8th and 9th, and then the 10th link is called existence. This is the case of the cause being given the name of its result, because the 10th link refers to the mental factor of intention. That is the ripened result of the negative karma, of the karma, positive or negative, that was ripened by the links of craving and grasping. So that strong grasping at existence, combined with craving, nurtured a karmic imprint, and then, which is the third link, karmic creation. So that ripened, and there's this, again, intention. Now remember, intention is equivalent to karma. In terms of creating a karmic potency, it's the intention, the will, the purpose behind our action, which is the main determining factor of whether it's going to be a positive or negative action. So that strong intention leads to the action, the action's finished, and the momentum, so a word, momentum, or the continuity of the power of our intention establishes the energy of the karmic potential that's born on the mind stream through time. Dormant, not manifesting. What causes that seed to ripen? The accomplishing karma, the 8th and 9th links, craving and grasping, cause it to germinate, and that germination, what is it? It is the mental factor of intention. It is a movement of the mind towards an object. Now this occurs, I'm preempting the last weekend, but it's an important point. This occurs as we're dying. And it's the last moment of when our mind has some capacity to distinguish between virtue and non-virtue. The karma for the next life is ripened. And so we call that existence. But if we look at it, what is it? It is intention, which will bring about the next existence. It is the throwing karma for the next life. But we're dying. And so the mind progressively becomes more and more subtle. But the karma's ripened. And so it goes into the subtle experiences up to the clear light, and then separation of the mind from the body at death, and still the reverberation, the momentum of that previous karmic action, which is now ripened as intention, that determines what type of dream you have, what type of intermediate bardo body you have, and it will be in the aspect of the future life. Then that will eventually meet up with parents of whatever type of rebirth you're going to take. And so, and still, the mind becomes more subtle. And then in the womb of the future mother, the fertilized egg, the mind becomes more coarse, and the winds become coarse, which we began this weekend on this point, is that same continuum of the ripened karma, the accomplished karma of intention, which causes the embryo to develop in the aspect of the future life, and then you've got it. You've got your type of human life. So that's what we talk about, accomplishing karma. It accomplishes the result, that the cause of which was created with the creation of the karmic potency, and it could have been lifetimes before, millions of lifetimes it could have been carried on the mind. So completing karma is the term that we give that having taken the rebirth, so it was a throwing karma and accomplishing karma which brought about our human form, our human life. But then all the experiences that we have during life are the completing karma. We've talked about already the results similar to the cause in terms of our experience, in terms of our habitual nature, and even our environment. So this is all the completing karma. So there's multiple karmas ripening throughout the day, giving all the varied experiences throughout our life. These are the other karmic consequences of past actions. So that's what we refer to when we talk about completing karma. Alright, am I giving you too much? Is it? Alright. You're still welcome to ask questions, but anyway, we'll get through the notes. The way karma ripens. So there's karma which, obviously strong karma, which definitely ripens. That karma can definitely ripen in the very life it's created. So the potency can germinate in the, like by getting hit over the head after gossiping at the stupa in Bodh Gaya. Can definitely ripen in this life. It can ripen in the very next life, or it will definitely ripen in a life after that. Even when we apply the opponent powers to this strong, definite karma, they, unless we meditate on emptiness, we will destroy it, but that's not easy to do. The opponent powers will weaken those definite karmas so that the result won't be as strong, but it will still definitely happen. Then there are less heavy karmic potencies, which are called indefinite. So they're intentionally done, but they're not strongly accumulated on the mind stream. And we've talked about, you know, killing out of compassion. So where the motivation is not totally negative, but there is some different feature. Another example is, you know, soldiers who are forced to kill. You know, if they don't kill, they'll be shot. They're sent into the battle, and you've got to kill the enemy. If you refuse to kill the enemy, then your own army will kill you. It's as heavy as that. So there are many soldiers who don't want to kill, but they're forced to. So in that situation, there isn't the real wish to kill, so the karma is not, it's indefinite. It's not necessarily going to rise. It's still negative, but it can be destroyed by opponent powers and so on. The general, you know, the leader of the troop of soldiers who may be sitting safely behind the lines, who sends the troops into battle, that general accumulates the karma of killing by every enemy soldier killed by his troops. Even though the general may not fire a gun, the general accumulates all the negative karma. So you can see the variation possible. So many variations. So indefinite karmas can be completely purified by the four opponent powers, or if they're virtuous, they can be destroyed by anger. So the result isn't definite to be experienced. They won't fade away from their own side, but they can be eliminated by other conditions. Then there's a presentation of karma according to the realm in which it throws its result, the rebirth result. So when you read the text, you might hear meritorious karma. So meritorious karma refers to karma that will bring about a happy rebirth in the desire realm as a human, as a demigod or asura, or as a divine being in one of the six desire realm heavens. So that's meritorious karma. Non-meritorious karma is karma which throws a rebirth result in an unhappy situation as an animal, hungry ghost, or a hell being. Unwavering karma is karma which will throw or cause birth in the form of formless realms. These are the other two realms of rebirth in samsara. So it's called unwavering because this karma is created in meditative concentration, where temporarily one suppresses all desire for sensory pleasure. It's not eliminated, but it is suppressed. And one's whole concentration is focused upon the mental experience of single-pointed concentration, of blissful, initially very blissful, and then peaceful and totally calm. And so there are many levels. So if in one's meditation one reaches any of those levels and one has a feeling of desire, affinity for this experience, one sees the experience that this is great, this is better than anything else, then when one dies, one will be reborn at that level of meditation in one of the formless realm rebirths. It's unwavering because that's the only result it will bring about. Whereas the other two, meritorious and non-meritorious karmas, the destiny can be altered by conditions. By applying four opponent powers towards non-meritorious karma, then karma for rebirth in the hells can ripen as a headache, as a human, or some sickness. When we do the Nyungne practice, I think there's one coming up in a few weeks here, then this is the two-day fasting retreat to Chenrezig. You've got a great opportunity here to do that retreat. And so the difficulties of fasting and not drinking, I won't experience as physical and mental difficulties. This is the changing of karma for rebirth in the lower realms into a temporary discomfort as a human being. So that's why they're wavering, but the single point of concentration are not wavering. When we die, the heaviest karma will ripen first. If our mind during that time when the karma for rebirth ripens, as our discriminations are weakening, if our mind is non-virtuous, the heaviest non-virtuous karmic potency will ripen first. If our mind is virtuous, the strongest virtuous karmic potency will ripen first. If two karmas are equal, if there's none is stronger than the other, virtuous or non-virtuous, then the most recently created karma will ripen first. If karmas were created at the same time and equal weight, the most habitual will ripen first. Okay, so that's just something to think about. Now, the question does come up. If I've got so many karmic potencies in my mind when I die, well, which one will ripen first? So let's explain. Next outline is karmic causes of insanity. So, well, it comes in this discussion. Insanity can be caused by causing others to become deranged by reciting spells or giving a magic concoction of herbs or whatever, or forcing them to take intoxicants or poisons against their will. Frightening wild animals, or setting a forest on fire, or throwing beings over a cliff, the terrible fear of falling. Any act, actually, which is deliberately undertaken to harm another's well-being can be a cause for disturbance of the mind. We say insanity, there's a whole spectrum of mental disturbances which could be called insanity. So, clearly, strongly disturbing another's mind creates a cause for that to be experienced oneself. We all know so many people who are apparently okay, normal, and suddenly they seem to become, or they do become, mentally disturbed, whether it's just depression, anxiety, or psychosis, whatever, then there are conditions in life which can precipitate the ripening of karmas we've created for mental disturbance. Perhaps we should use the term mental disturbance rather than insanity. So these conditions are strong fear, very strong fear, such as like we see a terrifying ghost. That's the example it gives in the Abhidhamma. Strong grief, such as the loss of a relative or somebody close to us. Strong grief can drive our mind, make it very disturbed. Harm, we can be external harm. There are malevolent spirits who share our environment, and it's possible to be harmed in such a way that we become mentally disturbed by spirits. Or finally, there's physiological imbalance. The in Tibetan medicine, they talk about the three physiological substances of wind, bile, and phlegm. So this describes sickness in relationship to these three qualities which are described in the medical texts. So there can be a reason, a karmic reason, why the wind, bile, and phlegm are disturbed or out of balance. And it's not just, there's karmic reasons behind every experience, but also different types of behavior can cause the imbalance of the normal physiological functioning of the body. So that's relation to mental disturbance. Then, the next outline talks about the eight favorable qualities for Dharma practice. So, see, well, I really want to practice Dharma, but there are so many things which make it hard for me to practice Dharma. So, realistically, it's going to be hard to achieve enlightenment in this lifetime. So, I want to come back in a situation as a human where I can best practice Dharma. So, in the Lum Room, there's a presentation of the eight aspects of life which help us to practice Dharma. And so what are the causes for those? So a long and healthy life clearly allows extensive practice of virtue and allows us to accumulate the merit and wisdom needed for Buddhahood. So the karmic causes for long life are refraining from killing or harming sentient beings, rescuing sentient beings to be killed. Next weekend, there's animal liberation, giving food to the hungry, releasing prisoners, nursing the sick, and so on. You know, looking after the lives of others. The karmic result is long and healthy life. So this is useful. We want to practice Dharma. Secondly, it's good to have an attractive body. Now, because we all want to be attractive, but usually from self-centered reasons, you know. But it's also around, it's in our society, a person who has an attractive body, then people are attracted to them. Their faith is increased. And so, if I want to help people, I want to attract people. So, it's good to have an attractive body. Lama Yeshe used to say, in the early days, in the 70s, all the hippies were in his audience, and he was trying to teach basic Dharma. And he said, "You people, renunciation is not to give up everything, to not enjoy life, to so on. If you go to a party, and if you put on best clothes and makeup and do your hair just for admiration for your own self, that's negative. But a beautiful person in a room is an attractive person. People like you. They're attracted to you. You can help them because they will take notice of you. So you should go to parties. You should wear the best clothes and you should wear makeup and you should do your hair properly." And it went on and on. And you can see why. It's true. It may be a failing in the minds of others of why they see an attractive person as better than an unattractive person. And that is a failing. But that's something we can use constructively from a Dharma point of view. So, the causes of being born with an attractive body, practicing patience, non-anger, making light offerings, making repairing statues, printing Dharma texts, offering clothing and ornaments, and so on. And born into a reputable family. It's also true. And particularly in India, we have the caste system, which was, pretty awful in the way the lower caste was discriminated against. But it was a reality. And if you're in a higher caste, people would listen to you. If you were from a lower caste, no chance. You wouldn't be allowed in the room, let alone teach Dharma. So, to benefit others, all the castes will listen to you if you're in the highest class. And we don't have the caste system here, but we do have reputable families and less reputable families. And we know all that person's the son or daughter of so-and-so, or they must be good, We'll pay more attention. We'll listen. Because of it may not be true that the son or daughter is actually reflecting the glory of their mother or father, but we pay attention. So, we want to help all sentient beings. Let's be born in a reputable family, so that people will pay attention to what we have to say in teaching Dharma. Not the me, me, me. So, the cause for that is not being proud of our education, not being proud of our social class, not being proud of our ethics, our wisdom, our circle of friends, our clothes, and showing respect for worthy objects such as gurus and one's parents. Then it's helpful to have wealth. We can want wealth just for me, but we can do so much to benefit others with wealth. Like, you know, the story of Ashoka, the king in India, who did so much with his great wealth to help the Dharma. So, the causes of wealth are making offerings to the Buddha images, repainting Buddha images, giving to the poor, and giving, helping others even when you're not asked. Another good advantage is have good speech, have credibility of speech. We've learnt how gossiping and harsh speech makes whatever we, even in the future life, our speech is incredible. People won't believe us. So if we want to be believed, then we abandon the four non-virtues of speech. On top of that, power to influence others, to really influence others. So with a good reputation, whatever you say will be accomplished quickly, exactly as we wish. The causes for this power are being respectful towards karmically potent beings. One's abbot, one's teacher, the three jewels, again, one's parents and elders. And then the seventh is related to India, a male body. So Indian society at that time, women were discriminated against. They were seen as a lower form of human being than males. We disagree with that. We can see the fault. We can see the social mistake. But the reality in India was that females were not listed. They weren't even allowed to be educated. They weren't given any opportunity other than doing the female activities of life. So, our society is different. There's so much more equality and recognition of the reality of equal capacity of both men and women. So, whatever is said about wanting a male body is equal if we want to be born as female. We want to be a feminine leader in society, which would be very good. We need very much. The males are letting the world down at the moment. So, equally, it could be either male or female. So, at the time of India, women could teach before large crowds. They wouldn't be listened to. And also, if women wanted to go into the wilderness and do retreat and so on, they were subjected to interference by males. They become the objects of, you know, males' desire and so on. So it was much more difficult at that time for a woman to receive teachings and to practice the Dharma. These days, different, equal opportunity. So, if we think of the future, I want to be a man or a woman, so we need the aspiration to be a man or a woman. That's that wish. We will be either male or female, but that won't be luck. It'll be our mental intention, our purpose, by seeing what I can do as a woman, how I can help society as a woman, how I can help society as a man, that's what I want to do. The final one is having a strong body and mind. Because you have the ability to endure austerities, to have no regret or hesitation, to fulfill the aims of others. So the causes of that are joyfully doing what others cannot do, helping and not hurting others, and so on. So those are the eight specific aspects of cause and effect. And I think they're good to think about because they do give us an indication of karma, cause and effect, how everything about our lives is influenced by past karma. But it's not, again, it's not our destiny. It is not preordained. And it is malleable. We can work with our karma. We can work with our future. In particular, the negative karmas can be overcome by the four opponent powers. So these powers oppose the four branches of creating negative karma. So sincere regret for past non-virtues is very important. So regret opposes the completion branch. Remember the four branches was the completion branch, so it opposes that. And it's by recognizing that we made a mistake, admitting that we made a mistake, and simply bringing that to mind, that, yep, I was wrong. Then the other powers, what we do about it. Regret is the first one, so that leads us to the next powers. The second is called the power of the basis. So the basis of negative karma is usually one of two. It's sentient beings or the three jewels. You know, we create negative karma. So the power of the basis is to aware of non-virtue, to reflect on refuge, the refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and strengthen one's faith and conviction in the Buddha Dhamma and our wish to practice. The second base, sentient beings, then this power of the basis is to generate compassion, a great compassion for sentient beings, and the determination to guide sentient beings out of suffering. So the power of the basis is training our mind on the foundation of regret to enhance our refuge, enhance our bodhicitta, our great compassion. The third power is an opposing action, the power of remedy. So this is to any virtuous action done with awareness of our past non-virtue, the thought, through this action may I purify that negative karma. So there are different examples, reciting the scriptures, such as the Heart Sutra, the Arya Sangata Sutra, and so on. Meditating on emptiness is the strongest, and as I've said, if we can actually generate the single-pointed, direct realization of emptiness, that will destroy all negative karma. There is no negative karma which cannot be destroyed. And not just weakened, but destroyed. Reciting mantras, many mantras, Vajrasattva, Chinrezi, and so on. Signs of success in our purification practice, maybe those who are going to do the Nyungne, and if you have a dream of you vomiting, or drinking milk, or eating yogurt, or you see the sun and the moon together, or you're walking in the sky, or you see a blazing fire, or you subdue a wild animal such as a water buffalo, or some demonic person, you see a group of Sangha, or you're riding on an elephant. These are dreams indicating purification is happening. Other actions, building statues, making offerings to the Buddha, to stupas, reciting names of 35 Buddhas and so on. And finally, there's the power of restraint. So this is the fourth opponent power, where you make a promise or a vow to not repeat the action. We have to be skillful. If we think we won't do it again for the rest of our life, then we say, until I die, I won't repeat the action. But if we think, oh, I might in the future, well, then we start, for the next 24 hours, I won't repeat the action. Right? And after 24 hours, we can do another day and even extend it. The point is, if we vow to not do an action again, but we break the vow, it's incredibly negative to break a vow. It's incredibly positive to keep a vow. So we have to be realistic. If we're pretty sure that we can't do the action in so many days, then take the vow for so many days and then reassess another week, and then maybe like that. All right, so the last outline you can read, the way purification happens. So instead of a harsh rebirth resulting from a powerful non-virtue, a lighter one is experienced. And so on. These are the... there is just six ways there of how putting the four opponent powers into practice can bring about a result. So the four opponent powers need to be practiced repeatedly, and as our understanding and as our capacity grows, then we'll get better and better and better. They'll be more and more efficient, and so we'll more and more purify negative karmas. So that completes the outline of this seminar, this weekend on karma. We've covered a lot of ground, and you know, I hope that you can go away, think about it, read more about it, and just try to be aware during the day, be mindful of this extra condition in life, the karmic cause and effect, and think about it in whatever you're experiencing and become more familiar with karma, and gradually, definitely, you'll automatically adjust your behavior of body, of your speech, and your mind. The easiest to control is our body, less easy is our speech, and even less easy is our thoughts, our mind. But having heard this description, how vital it is that we control our mind and our speech and our body. This is practicing Dharma and understanding karma gives us the motivation to resist all the inner temptations, the inner desires, the inner cravings, the inner ambitions for mundane happiness, mundane success, mundane power, wealth, and so on in society, to see the broader perspective of life and just how a human life presents us with such a unique opportunity. Animals can't understand karma. Hungry ghosts, hell beings, no chance. Divine beings, it's just too nice. It's just too nice in those experiences to want to modify one's behavior. And so complacency. So even amongst humans, when things are going very well, one is not inclined to practice Dharma. It's only when things are going really badly that we said, oh, I have to go to the temple, I have to say some mantras, I have to do something. If we're lucky, most people don't do that. They create more negative karma and enter this spiral back to the lower realms where they came from. Where we came from. Let's not go back. Okay. Again, I really thank you for your attendance. It's been very inspiring for me, for your interest, and to be able to share with you small things that I've learnt. Unfortunately, it's just words. It's not from my heartfelt practice, but it is my aspiration to be more conscious of karma throughout the day and night and to not waste my human rebirth. So let's collectively dedicate the positive energy of this weekend discussing on karma, the most important topic to learn. Dedicate this positive energy to others by thinking that I will definitely observe karma in my life abandon non-virtue and cultivate virtue. I will purify past non-virtue so that I can achieve my potential of Buddhahood and become a perfect guide to lead all mother sentient beings out of suffering. Thank you very much.